From Lima, Peru, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from COP20, the UN Climate Change Conference.
We, the people, have come together to stand up against injustice. We are saying enough is enough. In the COP where negotiations is taking place, the developed countries are putting profit before people. And we say no. You need to put people first before
thousands
profit.
March in Lima, Peru, calling for world leaders to do more to tackle climate change. We'll hear voices from around the world, as well as indigenous communities right here in Latin America, the most impacted by the extractive industries that fuel global warming.
For us, the Andean or indigenous community, they have eliminated our economy, including agriculture, textiles, and cattle raising. All of these things they have taken from us. Effectively, they have cut off our arms, and we are practically like walking dead.
We'll also hear from a woman whose brother was kidnapped and disappeared by Peruvian state forces. He was held here at El Pentagonito, the very site where the UN Climate Summit is taking place. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House is facing new pressure at home and around the world to hold officials accountable for CIA torture. Senate findings released this week provide new details on the CIA's abuses of foreign prisoners, as well as the extensive efforts it undertook to mislead the federal government, Congress, and the public. On Wednesday, outgoing Democratic Senator Mark Udall called for a purge of top CIA officials implicated in the abuses and the ensuing cover-up, including current director John Brennan. In stark language, Udall accused the CIA of lying.
The CIA has lied to its overseers and the public, destroyed and tried to hold back evidence, spied on the Senate, made false charges against our staff, and lied about torture and the results of torture. And no one has been held to account. They are, right now, people serving in high-level positions at the agency who approved, directed, or committed acts related to the CIA's detention and interrogation program. It's bad enough not to prosecute these officials, but to reward or promote them and risk the integrity of the U.S. government to protect them is incomprehensible. The president needs to purge his administration of high-level officials who are instrumental to the development and running of this program.
Senator Mark Udall's call was echoed around the world as details of the torture program were revealed. Speaking in Geneva, Rupert Colville, a spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said the U.S. obligation to prosecute over torture is crystal clear.
It's absolutely crystal clear. Torture is prohibited absolutely in all circumstances at any time. It cannot be practiced in war, in peace, during emergencies, during internal instability, any circumstances whatsoever. And the corollary of that is people who do practice it should be brought to trial.
Calling the practices gruesome, Germany's justice minister said everybody involved must be legally prosecuted. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani called the CIA's abuses, quote, inhuman and in violation of all accepted norms of human rights in the world. Ghani's comments come as the U.S. quietly announced it's closed its last remaining prison in Afghanistan at the Bagram Air Base, just one day after the torture report's release. In closing Bagram, the U.S. has handed over the last prisoners known to be in its custody in Afghanistan, including one prisoner whose torture is detailed in the Senate report. The Obama administration, meanwhile, standing by its longstanding refusal to prosecute Bush administration officials for carrying out torture. On Wednesday, the Justice Department said the Senate findings offer no new information to warrant reopening a previous investigation. At the White House, Press Secretary Josh Earnest said President Obama took sufficient action by ending the torture program when he took office.
The moral authority of the United States of America is one of the most powerful tools in our arsenal to protect and advance U.S. interests around the globe. And it's the view of the president that the use of these techniques, regardless of whether or not they elicit national intelligence information, undermine our ability to use this very powerful tool. And that is why the president outlawed these techniques in his first or second day in office.
As the torture fallout unfolds, one of the two psychologists who helped create the CIA's program has spoken out in his own defense. James Mitchell told Vice News the abuse of prisoners is preferable to the ongoing drone war that claims civilian lives.
To me, it seems completely insensible that slapping KSM is bad, but sending a Hellfire missile into her family's picnic and killing all the children and, you know, killing Granny and killing everyone is okay for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is, what about that collateral loss of life? And the other one is that if you kill them, you can't question them.
With new details of Mitchell and Jessen's role exposed, the American Psychological Association, or APA, has renewed calls for the pair to be held accountable. Rhea Farberman of the APA spoke out on Wednesday.
We were distressed and frankly sickened by some of the brutal details. The techniques that were described are clearly torture. They are a violation of everything that our discipline stands for. They are clearly a violation of human rights and international law. As I said earlier, the two psychologists who apparently were involved are not members of our association. They're therefore beyond the reach of our ethics program. But regardless, they should be held accountable. If these allegations are true, they should be held accountable for very serious violations of U.S. law and international law.
In other news, a government shutdown is back on the table today as top Democrats object to corporate-friendly measures tucked into an omnibus spending bill. The $1.1 billion measure was negotiated ahead of tonight's midnight deadline to fund the government and keep federal agencies from closing their doors. But Democrats are now opposing several last-minute provisions, including one that would repeal a key rule in the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill that limits risky trades by federally insured banks. On Wednesday, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren accused the financial giant Citigroup of authoring the rule change.
Citigroup is large and it is powerful, but it is a single private company. It shouldn't get to hold the entire government hostage, to threaten a government shutdown in order to roll back important protections that keep our economy safe. This is a democracy, and the American people didn't elect us to stand up for Citigroup. They elected us to stand up for all the people.
Another amendment would increase tenfold the amount of money allowed for certain political donations. Republicans say they're open to a 1 or 2 day extension, but have rejected Democratic calls to remove the pro-corporate provisions. But with Democrats still in control of the Senate, Republicans won't be able to pass the spending bill without bipartisan support. Protests continue nationwide 1 week after a grand jury chose not to indict a New York City police officer for the chokehold death of Eric Garner. On Wednesday, students at around 70 medical schools nationwide staged joint die-ins, donning white lab coats and laying their bodies on the ground. In New York City, the group Picture the Homeless staged a rally at the right-wing Manhattan Institute before a march to Penn Station, where they held a die-in for 11 minutes. That's 11 for the amount of times Garner repeated his last words, "I can't breathe." Protesters called for the repeal of the NYPD policy, broken windows.
This is not a valid theory. It is used to harass the poor, the people of color, and the homeless.
It basically focuses on issues that's not really a crime, where you could just get a small ticket and you don't have to be taken down and handcuffed to central booking. It's ridiculous.
All Also Wednesday, the group New York Justice League presented a series of demands to state officials in a rally at City Hall. The Justice League's agenda includes the firing of the officer who killed Eric Garner, Daniel Pantaleo, and the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate the case. The group was joined by prominent hip-hop artists Nas, Common, and Q-Tip, as well as the mogul and activist Russell Simmons. And a federal judge has given the White House a deadline of next Tuesday to decide whether it will prosecute New York Times reporter James Risen. The government has ordered Risen to testify at the trial of a former CIA officer, Jeffrey Sterling, who's accused of giving him classified information about the agency's failed operation to deliver faulty nuclear bomb blueprints to Iran. Risen has fought his subpoena for years, but lost an attempt to bring the case before the Supreme Court in June. If the Obama administration now forces him to testify, James Risen has said he's prepared to serve jail time rather than reveal his source. To see our interview with Jim Risen, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from COP20, the United Nations Climate Conference in Lima, Peru, where Secretary of State John Kerry is due to arrive today as the talks enter their final 2 days. The last time a U.S. Secretary of State attended the summit was Hillary Clinton in 2009 in Copenhagen. Leaders from about 190 nations are trying to work out a draft deal to limit rising global greenhouse gas emissions ahead of next year's summit in Paris, where an agreement's expected to be finalized. On Wednesday, the presidents of Peru, Chile, Mexico, and Colombia urged negotiators to take significant steps towards combating global warming. This is Chilean President Michelle Bachelet.
We know that if we don't reach an agreement at the next conference in Paris, it's possible that we will be too late. The success of COP21 next year will depend to a great degree on the agreements reached here, and that means that we have no right to fail. Future generations will hold us accountable, and with good reason, if we allow this opportunity to go by.
On Wednesday, thousands of people marched here in downtown Lima, Peru, to call for action on climate change, among them members of Peru's more than 50 indigenous communities. Across Latin America, indigenous and rural communities are among the most impacted by mining, oil drilling, and other extractive industries that fuel global warming. They're also among those most vulnerable to the effects of climate change. Democracy Now!'s Amy Littlefield spoke to members of those frontline communities. Some had traveled to Lima, Peru, from as far away as Mexico.
My name is Venancia Cruz Dominguez. I come from the indigenous movement of Santiago de Anaya in Hidalgo, Mexico.
Municipios que ya están siendo afectadas por el...
There are six municipalities whose environment is being contaminated by the company Cementos Fortaleza, whose owner is Carlos Slim, a huge magnate considered the richest and most powerful man in the world. Yet he came to rob our clean air, our tranquility, and to take away our water.
Nuestro aire limpio nos vino a robar nuestra tranquilidad, nos vino a quitar el agua.
The impact is being felt in the environment. Every morning we rise to see plants and outdoor furniture covered with a thin film. The crops of my neighbors are being impaired by this thin film that is produced by Cementos Fortalezas in Santiago de Anaya.
My name is Isabel Valdivia Martinez, and I am a defender of the Amazon and a Peruvian. And sadly, I see that a North American, Dennis Nicholas Melka, with 20 companies, is deforesting all the Amazon, including virgin forest and secondary forest, to replace it with palm oil. Daily, they knock down 1,000 hectares of virgin forest, affecting the biodiversity, the flora, the fauna, the water, all of that to exploit palm and to industrialize it for biodiesel.
My name is Atok Kurlakanki. How does climate change impact us? First of all, there is no rain anymore. The rivers have dried up because the miners use water, and that water is poisoned, and the animals die. For us, the Andean or indigenous community, they have eliminated our economy, including agriculture, textiles, and cattle raising. All of these things they have taken from us. Effectively, they have cut off our arms, and we are practically like walking dead.
My name is Paxi. In Aymara, it means moon. And I'm here to raise awareness, to say to all of humanity that we have to return to the heart of Mother Earth. We have to wake up. We have to unite. It's time to say enough. We have to return because the Aymara, we live together with the environment. We Aymara live together with the earth, and we're being impacted because right now the Aymara people are suffering from drought.
El pueblo Aymara sufre de sequía. Es por eso que le pido a los grandes representantes del mundo.
And that's why I'm asking the great representatives of the world to wake up, that the change begins now, that the change begins in every corner of the earth. This is the message that we bring, the cosmic message to every corner of the earth from the wisdom of our ancestors.
That report produced by Amy Littlefield and John Hamilton. Special thanks to our Spanish team at Democracy Now!, Clara Ibarra and Andres Contreras. You can see our Spanish coverage of the COP at democracynow.org by clicking on the tab Español. Thousands of people did march in Lima, Peru, here on Wednesday, demanding urgent action on climate change. Democracy Now!'s Dina Guzder and Nermeen Sheikh spoke to some of them.
I'm Robert, I'm from Uganda. I work with an environmental NGO, and what we are doing now here is sending a message to the COP that we need climate justice now. We need commitments now. Climate change is affecting the development, is affecting the landscapes, is affecting food security, and manifestations already there. People are trying to survive in hard conditions. Poverty levels are growing up because people cannot cope up with this changing weather. The developed nations, the way they developed was they polluted the environment because they are industrialized countries. And when they polluted the environment, they were on their course to development. So what we are telling them now is to reduce their development models, turn to clean energy, follow the commitments they agreed on, reducing greenhouse gases, and also put finances and technology for countries also to achieve the level of development they also did.
My name is Tetet Lauron. I'm from Ibon International, and I'm from the Philippines. Well, you know, we've been hearing message of sympathy from everyone here at the COP. But right now, at the moment, we're saying that we've had enough of the sympathy, and what we need now is genuine solidarity. This is the third COP where the Philippines has been the center of attention because of the super typhoons that has been hitting our country during the time of these climate meetings. So I suppose, you know, the Philippines is the poster child for all climate disasters, but what I'm saying is it's the Philippines now, but you know, we're just representative of many other vulnerable communities, many other drowning people and drowning communities, but more importantly, many other communities all over the world who are fighting for meaningful solutions to climate change.
My name is Godwin Ojo, Environmental Rights Action, Friends of the Earth Nigeria. We, the people, have come together to stand up against injustice. We are saying enough is enough. In the COP where negotiations is taking place, the developed countries are putting profit before people. And we say no, you need to put people first before profit. And therefore, it is time to make sure that we condemn dirty energy. We say no more to coal, no more to nuclear, no more to all forms of dirty energy. Therefore, keep the oil in the soil, keep the coal in the hole, keep the tar sand in the sand. Oil has become doom. Oil has become a curse. Oil has become all forms of injustice in Nigeria. Shell and the oil companies, they are laughing to the banks. The community's land has been taken. The communities are dying every day. They are crying to the hospital. They are crying to mortuaries. This is why we say enough of it, this injustice. And therefore, oil companies, Shell, they have no part in this COP. We kick them out of this COP. We kick them out of the economy, the future economy of Nigeria. And we kick them out of a sustainable energy future.
My name's Alison Fleming, and I'm from Canberra in Australia.
What does your sign say?
My sign says, Abbott, you're an old fossil. As many of you are aware, COP Australia has just been named the worst industrial nation. We have dropped 21 positions since the last conference of the parties, and it's directly related to the fact that the carbon tax has been reversed. We wanted to come out today and say that not all Australians support the action of the Australian government. There are many, many Australians that believe in action for climate change and action now.
And how has climate change affected Australia in particular?
Climatic variation is really noticeable. Within 1 week, we can have snowstorms to bushfires, and in different parts of the country, we'll have flooding. So farmers are finding that climatic conditions are very hard to know when to plant, how to plant. There's huge variation. It's just destroying whole crops for entire years.
My name is Dipti Bhatnagar with Friends of the Earth International, Climate Justice and Energy Coordinator from Mozambique. We are in desperate need of building our climate justice movement, demanding climate justice. We have a planetary emergency. We have millions that are already affected by climate change, and the situation is only going to get much worse. We are here observing the UN climate change negotiations, but we are here because we want to build with the Peruvian and the Latin American movements. We want to build a climate justice movement. We want to also continue to challenge, right? We want to name and shame those who are really responsible.
And who are those who are responsible?
At this point, it's the developed countries who are blocking everything at the negotiations, who are removing all of their obligations for finance, who are pretending as if the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change doesn't exist, trying to dismantle historical responsibility, trying to dismantle equity. And we're here to fight back and say, sorry, you cannot, you absolutely cannot do that. We are watching, the world is watching, civil society is watching, and we're going to fight back.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is supposed to speak at the climate change conference. What would your message be to him if you could sit down at the table with him?
Take your responsibility. Stop running away from your responsibility. Stop trying to damage historical responsibility. Stop trying to undermine equity. Bring the finance, you know, do the emission cuts. And whatever the U.S., the latest U.S.-China declaration has been, is pitiful. It's a drop in the ocean compared to what the U.S. should be doing to reduce emissions.
And my name is Elizabeth May. I'm the leader of the Green Party of Canada. I am a member of parliament for the riding of Saanich and the Gulf Islands, and I'm the only opposition member of parliament from Canada attending the conference of the parties due to the anti-climate bias of our prime minister. No opposition party members are allowed on our official delegation, so I'm here as an observer. I have been at every COP for a very long time. We know that at the next COP, we're going to have to come to a conclusion at COP21. I was in Copenhagen for the disaster there. And we will have an election in Canada between now and COP in Paris. It's critical that Stephen Harper go. It's critical that MPs with a commitment to climate action are elected. But at least one of us has to know the thread of the negotiations so that we can work together to forge a much stronger climate treaty than anything that's currently being negotiated here.
My name is Diego Parilla. I live in Lima. I come from Proyecto Lomas, and we are attempting to save the last largest ecosystem that we have in our city. In the city that is hosting the COP20, we are really, really not taking into account the destruction of the Lomas around the city, and that's not acceptable. As civil society, we go out to the streets and claim to our authorities to take care of that, because we need that. It's the last ecosystem that we have in the capital of Peru.
And what do you think is happening at COP20?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
What do you hope this march will accomplish? What do you want this march to accomplish?
Inspire more people to join this fight all around the world, because this is happening and this is affecting every single people around us. So we all need to gather. We all need to take to raise awareness about what's happening and take actions at the local level and at the global level.
My name is Blessing Mtiti, and I originally come from Zimbabwe, but I'm staying in South Africa. I'm coming representing an organization called Project 90 by 2030, and I'm on the youth leadership program, which is called You Lead Collective. My message to the climate negotiators is they should remember to consider and to consider intergenerational equity in all the negotiations that are going to happen. If they don't consider this in Lima, there is no Paris Agreement next year. For countries in Africa, we also need climate finance for adaptation and mitigation to happen. So there's no just transition if we do not finance the climate change impacts that are actually happening, because there's already enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that is causing tremendous climate change impacts on Africa. And yet, African nations, they do not have any resources to adapt and to mitigate for climate change.
Compañeras, compañeros, es un honor para nosotros compartir este momento histórico con ustedes.
My name is Matro Awayakapi. People know me as Tom Goldtooth, director of the Indigenous Environmental Network from Minnesota, United States. And one of the things that we're also doing is creating a new paradigm from the corporate takeover of nature, the privatization of nature, and educating people of the world that we need to create a recognition of earth jurisprudence, the rights of nature. The only that in our mentality and our spirituality and our connection to Mother Earth is one of the things that's going to turn this around and to mobilize what we have done in the North by forming alliances like the Climate Justice Alliance and forming a voice for the people on the front lines of struggle. This is the largest gathering I hear march in Peru's history. We're going to build this momentum and take it to Paris and where people will organize throughout the world. This is something where indigenous peoples are rising, social movements are rising, women are rising for the future of our children. Long live the indigenous peoples. Long live Peru. Long live our women. Long live the social movements. So long live the workers. Long live the right of the water of life.
Voices from the People's Climate March here in Lima, Peru. That piece was produced by Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, and Hani Massoud. We'll be back in a minute. Corporation, El Pueblo Unido, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Lima, Peru, at the United Nations Climate Change Conference, known as COP20. After the main march of thousands on Wednesday, hundreds headed across town to protest a corporate meeting called the World Climate Summit. Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz was there and filed this report.
This is Renee Feltz with Democracy Now! We're in a small park in downtown Lima. Many of the protesters that we've come across here have just come from the major march, some say the largest climate march in Latin America's history. Now they've had a general assembly of sorts, it looks like Occupy here in Lima, and we're going to move again. It looks like we're heading towards a hotel. Let's find out where they're going. I'm here with Pasco Sabado, one of the people we've had on the program this week. Now he's outside the COP and in the streets. Can you tell us what's going on here? Where are we going?
So we're going to the World Climate Summit. Some would have thought that actually the COP, COP20, was the World Climate Summit, but no. 500 of the biggest business leaders decided to have their own summit, where they claim on their website this is where the influence takes place. It's the most influential event of the year with governments and business leaders. So we're going to go pay them a visit, see what they have to say, and actually make it known that the power lies with us, the people, not them, the corporations, that they are the ones causing this crisis, and they're not the ones to get us out of it. So it's, we're talking here about system change, not climate change, and that it's us, the people, who are going to provide the solutions from below.
We've left the park, we've taken the street in downtown Lima. We're going to talk to some people who are participating in this march. Hi, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Raquel, I'm from Brazil.
And what brings you out here today with your friend with this cactus?
We want to show everyone here at this COP that in Brazil, especially in São Paulo, we have no water for all the population, and nobody knows about it. So the idea is to show it with this amazing intervention by Mundano, my friend here.
And why don't you have any water?
Because of climate change, of course. Consciente, jamás será silente. El
pueblo consciente, jamás será. The protest continues as the corporate meetings continue. The people are chanting, the people awakened will never be servants. And what separates the protest and the people in the streets from the corporations and the suites here is a line of police. They're wearing shields. They're wearing face shields. They're holding large shields. And many of them are holding what looks like tear gas launchers. And we'll see if that's deployed.
So we arrived just outside the Hilton. This is where all these business leaders are meeting for the World Climate Summit. And the police have formed two lines with another line behind them. And we're wondering, we're working out what to do collectively. This is, they tried to ask us to identify leaders here so that those leaders can then go inside and talk to people. But all they want to do is identify people, probably to arrest them. And this is a spontaneous movement. This is people who have the interest of the entire communities at stake. And we're not going to go inside. We've got nothing to say to them. Our messages are here. If they want to speak to us, they can come to us.
Multinacionales, fuera de nuestros países.
Multinationals, out of our countries.
En Colombia, al igual que en cualquier país de América.
In Colombia, like any country in Latin America, we live the invasion of the transnationals, where they are imposing a model that is an extraction model, financed by dispossession, where the transnational companies want to have control of our territories, to extract intensively our natural riches, exploit intensively our workforce, with the only goal of accumulating capital for all of their monopolies, generating the greatest ecocide in the history of humanity.
My name is Ruth Nyambura. I come from Kenya and I work for the African Biodiversity Network.
And Ruth, have you been inside the COP this year?
Yes, I've been inside the COP this year, up until yesterday, but also been going to the Cumbre since it began on Monday. I've had a few sessions here, mostly led by the people you're seeing in the protests here. So Cumbre has been a space, it's been like the alternative space where real issues, systemic and structural issues are being tackled, proper analysis, where we're trying to build a new and just world, where we're trying to dismantle the system of oppression that we currently have.
I just heard that the police were looking for the leaders here to perhaps go inside or perhaps arrest. If you were to go inside this meeting where all these corporations are gathered, what would you tell them?
I probably shouldn't say what I would tell them on air unless you promise everyone is over 18. But they need to get the hell out of our world. Our world is not for sale. They need to get the hell out of our world. There are no two ways about it. That's our minimum non-negotiable. Our world is not for sale. Our dignity is not for sale. And we refuse to bow down to colonization and neo-colonization. And even if we can't get to Hilton, we will dismantle the systems of oppression. Yes, just a matter of time.
In the end, the nonviolent protest against the corporate-sponsored World Climate Summit ended with just one arrest. That report by Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz and John Hamilton at the World Climate Summit here in Lima, Peru, where we're broadcasting live all week from the UN Climate Conference. Yes, we are broadcasting from the COP20. The summit's being held at the Peruvian Army headquarters known as El Pentagonito. It's a site with a dark history. It was built in 1975 by the dictator Juan Velasco Alvarado. The army under President Alberto Fujimori later used the base to torture and interrogate political prisoners. One of the people who joined the march against the World Climate Summit on Wednesday was Marley Ansualdo Castro, who held a sign reading, "No olvidamos," we don't forget, with a picture of El Pentagonito. Her brother, Kenneth, was disappeared in 1993 during the reign of Fujimori. Last year, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights determined the state was responsible for his forced disappearance. The court found state agents kidnapped Ansualdo Castro and brought him to the basement of Peru's Army Intelligence Service, known as SIE, located here at El Pentagonito. To this date, his whereabouts remain unknown. On Wednesday, Marley Ansualdo Castro spoke to Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz.
My name is Marley Ansualdo Castro. I'm the sister of Kenneth Ansualdo Castro. He was a student who disappeared 21 years ago in the Pentagonito. I'm also here because they are murdering nature, and also because the peasant leaders who are struggling for water are also being killed. The same thing happened years ago, when young people fought for student welfare and opposed what the government did at that time. They were kidnapped and disappeared. Currently, there's a trial in the criminal division of the Callao Naval Base for the forced disappearance of two students, including my brother and a teacher, who was a professor at the University of San Cristóbal de Huayamanga of Ayacucho.
Can you tell us what exactly happened to your brother and why was he targeted?
During the 1980s to 2000, Peru went through an internal armed conflict. Students, especially from public universities, were considered potential terrorists. My brother offered to be a witness around the case of the disappearance of a young man named Martin Roca Casas. 2 days before going to testify in front of the district attorney, my brother disappeared. It was December 16th, 1993. This year, it will be 21 years. He was a young man committed to student activism at the university and to reclaiming the rights of the people. So I join young people today because my brother had that spirit. So for me, it is a way to see him alive now. And that is my motivation to be here today. And even more because of the water, the earth, life.
Can you tell us how you feel about the COP being hosted in the shadow of El Pentagonito and the police here behind you?
Saberlo me indignó muchísimo. Y
Yes, knowing about it made me feel very outraged. I was already outraged before because the site became a place where fashion shows were happening. It became a place for concerts. Actually, this made me feel helpless and angry because the government did this even after discovering a furnace where people were cremated.
Porque el gobierno en ese entonces que sabían ya que se había descubierto un horno ahí donde incineraban las personas y de hecho
a human remain was found there too. It was the right-hand phalanx finger of a person about 25 years old. And that was precisely the average age of the young people who had disappeared. Students.
Han sido los jóvenes que tenían ese promedio de edad los que han desaparecido en su mayoría, estudiantes.
Now the COP is there. On the surface, they're struggling for the planet, but the people in power have another agenda. If anything inspired me to come out in the streets today, it's that I'm not afraid.
Algo me dio salir a las calles. Ahora es que no tengo miedo. He considerado que la vida.
I think that life and rights have always been one with struggles, and so therefore that fight is part of life. So that's why I joined the protests. I'm not afraid anymore, and the police only obey orders. They're not the bad guys. I know that the bad guys are the ones who are in power and don't know how to govern.
That was Marley Anzualdo Castro. Her brother Kenneth disappeared here at El Pentagonito in 1993. Here is where the UN World Climate Summit, the UN Climate Change Conference, COP20, is taking place. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at a new report called Peru's Deadly Environment. Stay with us. Tanya Libertad here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Lima, Peru, where the United Nations Climate Change Conference is underway. The protests against the summit on Wednesday fell on International Human Rights Day, which seems fitting because Peru is now the fourth most dangerous country for environmental defenders, with four killed in September alone in a brutal incident in a remote region of Peru's Amazon rainforest. A leading indigenous activist named Edwin Chota was ambushed as he traveled to neighboring Brazil for a meeting on how to address the region's illegal logging crisis. It was those same illegal loggers who allegedly killed and dismembered Chota, along with his colleagues, Jorge Rios, Francisco Pinedo, and Leoncio Quintasima. This is Edwin Chota speaking about how his life had been repeatedly threatened.
There are good business people, but there are others who are only evil, who threaten to kill. We are threatened, but we welcome death. Why? For the defense of our nature, our life, and our children's future. The law has not yet come to us. We do not feel the law, and our villagers are threatened. Threatened because we do not take this.
In fact, that was Edwin Chota. We're going to turn right now to Chris Moy, the environmental governance campaigner for Global Witness. He's here at the climate conference, author of a new report called Peru's Deadly Environment. I asked him to lay out his findings.
As you rightly pointed out, Peru is the second most dangerous country in Latin America and the fourth most dangerous country in the world to be an environmental land defender, with 57 killings over between 2002 and 2014. And when we looked at the sectors that are most responsible for those killings, there are two. That's the extractive sector and the forest sector. The extractive sector saw 80% of all of those killings, so 40 cases over the decade. And the forest sector saw five high-profile killings in the last 2 years of anti-illegal logging activists. And there are two primary causes for it. Now, the immediate causes of those killings and the underlying governance problems that our report looks at, right? In terms of the immediate causes, we're seeing 73% of those cases over the last decade were at the hands of state security forces. And this has a long history in Peru, going back to Fujimori and even beyond. And in terms of the underlying causes, you're seeing weakening environmental legislation in the extractive sector. You're seeing a failure to properly implement free, prior, and informed consent for indigenous communities. And in the forest sector, you're seeing, you know, massive rates of illegal logging, ranging from 80 to 90% of total logging. And also, you're seeing huge problems in terms of monitoring the flow of illegal timber, and finally of land titling, land pending land title applications for indigenous communities that mainly reside in the Amazonian forest sector.
I wanted to turn back to Edwin Chota. While Democracy Now! Was here in Lima, I spoke with Edwin Chota's widow, Julia Perez, as well as with Irgilia Rengifo, the widow of Jorge Rios, about the work their husbands were doing before they were killed, which they are now carrying on. In this clip, Julia Perez, Chota's widow, begins by describing her husband's murder as she cradles her infant son, Edwin Chota Jr., in her arms.
Your husband's remains have been found. How did Edwin Chota and the other men die?
Bueno, nosotros no lo han visto. Lo mismo como negros que se fueron adelante.
What happened was when Edwin and the others were walking, they were walking towards Brazil through the forest, and there were a group of them, and a few of them had gone ahead, further ahead, and had walked faster, and were waiting at some point, and got tired of waiting, and turned around to find out, you know, what was taking the other guys so long.
A las cinco, de las seis quizás llega esas horas. Y ahí recién nosotros nos enteramos que ellos ya no existen, que le han muerto.
And they returned back on the path, and they found the bones and the remains, no longer the bodies, but just the bones of Edwin Chota and Jorge Rios and the other two. And that's when they returned to the village, and that's when we found out that Edwin Chota and our husbands were no longer. And they came back to the community and told us then, and they told me, and we told Edgilia and the other widows of the leaders who were killed.
Estamos cansados de esperar, no viendo que no llega, y ese retorno que le haya ya. Ya no cuerpo ya, sino puro hueso ya. Pido yo justicia, señorita. Eso es lo que yo pido. Por favor,
I demand justice. That's what I ask. Even though they don't take much notice, we've been struggling for years, and this saddens me. Let the culprits find out what it's like to suffer. That person should be found dead, detained, and put in prison. Their families should suffer as we are suffering, because the truth is, they get off easy. They're happy with their families who they cherish, but for four of us, no father will be around to cuddle with their children. For example, I have my baby, who's 5 months old. What father will cherish my son? Who will give him tender, loving care?
No hay. En cambio, ellos van a salir porque estoy escuchando que ellos tienen, dice, con llama.
Instead, they get to go free, because I've heard that they have more rights than us. How can that be?
Más derecho que nosotros. ¿Cómo va a ser así?
That's Irgilia Rengifo, who is the widow of Jorge Rios, and before that, Edwin Chota's widow, Julia Perez, both holding their infants, their husbands, killed in the last months. Chris Moy, as you document this, it is believed they were killed by illegal loggers who have not been held accountable yet, but that's not the majority of the Peruvian earth defenders that have been killed. And then let's go broader to the world.
Sure. I mean, at the global level, in April, we published a report, Deadly Environment, that documented 908 killings of environmental land defenders. But primarily, 50% of those happen, though, in Latin America. So it's clear that Latin America is a very dangerous continent, Peru being the second most dangerous country.
And what does rolling back environmental regulation have to do with the killings of these environmentalists?
Sure. So, for example, in Peru, there's a very high-profile case that happened in 2009 called the Bagua case, and that related to indigenous communities protesting against numerous laws that the Alan Garcia government of the time was trying to pass, trying to roll back environmental legislation, namely weakening the environmental impact assessment process, weakening the ability of the Ministry of Environment to assign protected areas, leading indigenous communities to protest against the fact that they were not consulted about these laws because these laws directly affect them as they live in the areas where these extractive sector projects are likely to take place, and you know they live in protected areas. Edwin Chota's case is emblematic of a wider forest sector problem, which is that Edwin had been fighting for a decade to title his communities a forested area, and there are over 20 million hectares of pending land titles from indigenous communities, all of whom reside in the Amazon region and the forest areas. If you want to best protect those forests, you assign those land titles to them.
An Ecuadorian Shore indigenous leader who opposed a major mining project was found dead just days before he was due to speak here in Lima. José Isidro Tendenza Antun had opposed the Mirador open pit copper and gold mine, which would devastate swaths of the southern Amazon. Well, on Monday, I had a chance to speak with Narcisa Alcai. She was a neighbor of José Isidro Tendenza Antun, and I met her at a panel of women earth activists. And she described what happened to her neighbor, the slain activist, who they were waiting for to speak here in Lima. She's translated by Amazon Watch's Atosa Saltani.
We were surprised because I had to leave for Quito to come to Lima, and then when I got there, I started to hear that he had died, and that they had the police had basically buried him without the permission of his family, and that seems really rare that we didn't know that he was dead. No one had notified anyone in the community that he had passed, and that later we come to Quito and we find out that he'd already been buried.
No
one really knows why he was killed, and the reason has to be investigated. But what we know is that he was tortured. His arms were broken. His hands were tied. They had tied his arms and broken his arms and then tied him in the back and then throw him in the river.
Does his death make you afraid?
From the news reports, from the information I've received from Domingo Anquash, the Shuar leader, his arms were broken and he was tied up and he was killed in this brutal way, tortured. Of course that makes me scared. I know when God calls me, I'm going to die, but I don't want to die like that. And of course this scares me.
That is Narcisa Alcai, neighbor of José Isidro Tendenza Antun, at a panel of women environmentalists here in Lima. We just bumped into her afterwards. Now, Chris Moy, this is a neighboring Ecuador. Can you talk about what this threat means, as she was describing, the message these killings are having?
Sure. Well, in the Amazonian region, over the last two or three years, you're seeing a rise in the killings of indigenous activists fighting against their forests being handed over to the extractive sector or to the logging industry. And that particular case is quite emblematic of also another interesting phenomenon, which is that you're seeing greater investment by Chinese companies and Chinese banks, etc., in the region, in extractive sector projects and infrastructure projects that affect forested areas, as Canadian companies and as American companies and European companies sell their companies to the Chinese companies because they unsuccessfully tried to extract. extract those resources or to have some kind of problem there. So that case is emblematic of these wider killings. And these wider killings have happened over the last 2-3 years and have intensified.
I want to turn to Wilfredo Saavedra Moreiros, president of the Environmental Defense Front of Cajamarca in the Andes of northern Peru. Through mass protests, residents of the region have successfully stalled plans by the U.S. firm Newmont to destroy mountain lakes in order to construct the massive open pit Conga gold mine. In 2012, the struggle made national headlines when police waged a crackdown, killing 5 people. Peruvian President Ollanta Humala has backed the Conga mine project. Saavedra and fellow environmental defenders have traveled across Peru to denounce the project in Lima. On Monday, they marched through the streets to demand protection of their water. And Saavedra talked about repression they faced on their journey.
We have made an effort, even though they have criminalized our social protest, even though the police have tried to prevent us from arriving in Lima, they have seized our cars. There's been constant police harassment of a lot of our marching brigades. Because we have come from town to town, making use of our own resources, making community meals to feed ourselves from the 3rd of December until this morning when we arrived here in Lima. And despite all of that, they have not been able to break our unity and our fierce will to come here to Lima to express ourselves.
That was Wilfredo Saavedra Moreiros, president of the Environmental Defense Front of Cajamarca in the Peruvian Andes. Chris?
Yeah, and that's really indicative of a problem that Peru's had over the last decade in terms of state security forces killing environmental and land defenders. And interestingly enough, the Humala government recently passed a law 30151, which grants immunity from prosecution for state security forces as they carry out their duties in the case that they should use violence against, say, peaceful protesters. So the primary agents of the killings of environmental land defenders in Peru are now being given carte blanche to essentially, you know, crack down and use as much violence as they want, and they will not be prosecuted. And furthermore, in the decade that preceded the passage of this law, not one single individual policeman or army official was taken to court and prosecuted for the killings of these defenders. So that it's really an outrage, and civil society has come out strongly against it, including Amnesty International, that has called it a major breach of the right to peaceful assembly.
You know, that's very interesting in light of where we're speaking right now. We're speaking in Pentagonito, right? Mm-hmm. This is where the UN summit is taking place. Wilfredo Saavedra Moreiros, the president of the Environmental Defense Front of Cajamarca, who we just heard, was denouncing this also on the street, that the UN climate summit that is taking place here at Pentagonito, that the COP is a sham as he marched through the streets of Lima.
COP 20 is nothing more than a kind of deception. It's a farce. That's how we perceive it. The representatives of the states of the world are meeting in a place that is stained with blood. In the Pentagonito, that military base, they have extrajudicially executed our brothers. They have burned them. They have disappeared them. Many people, including members of the Andean police, were burned there. And that cannot be anything but a display of the public shame of what Peru is. Ollanta Humala, being the host of the governments of the world, spending millions of dollars, close to $90 million for this summit that doesn't accomplish anything other than lyrical declarations of commitments against the effects of climate change. They have not amounted to anything for 20 years. And today, the people cannot be heard because they have created security zones, 5 security zones, where we are not going to be able to get in. We're not going to be able to get in to express our position, our voice.
Moreiros, president of the Environmental Defense Fund of Cajamarca, denouncing the COP being right here in Pentagonito, which, you know, we see we're sort of in the shadow of it and have learned about where so many were killed and tortured here, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. And it paints a kind of murkier image of the progressive image that Peru is trying to portray to the world in terms of its fight against climate change. The progressive image it likes to portray is that, look, we're we're going to conserve 75% of our forests in an effort to stop deforestation, which, as we know, accounts for 50% of all greenhouse gas emissions here in Peru. And we're also going to reduce to zero net deforestation by 2020. But the reality, as we've just heard, is far different. I mean, you're looking at environmental land defenders being killed, precisely trying to protect the forests against extractive sector projects. And also, the government of Peru has assigned almost 20 million hectares to the oil industry and to the logging industry in the Amazon. So there's this kind of contradiction between its progressive image of trying to conserve its forests, but at the same time prioritizing extractive sector development, which will lead to deforestation and greater greenhouse gas emissions.
That was Chris Moy of Global Witness. I'm Amy Goodman at the COP20 here in Lima, Peru.